Judy and I have been having a really good time getting acquainted this afternoon. She's been just such a big help in finding me a place to stay and showing me the whole building and telling me a little bit about it. I have to tell you, Judy, about looking at the music. That you, if you look further on the website, you see the fine print about the way that I teach banjo. It's all done by ear. We don't ever look at any sheet music or any tablature. So the first thing I'd like to do is pick a banjo tune for you. And I'm just going to just get... Can I be down here, Scott?
Come on, sir.
That's fine.
Great. I'm just going to pick a banjo tune. I am a professional banjo player, and Judy said that I'm a teacher. I'm a banjo teacher. I'm not a school teacher. This is what I do for a living, teach people to play the banjo by ear. And so I picked out a tune to start off with, which I think is sort of appropriate for the talk that I'm going to be giving about women in bluegrass. It's one called Banjo Picking Girl. Thank you very much. So now that I've sort of established my credentials as a banjo picker, let me tell you just a little bit more about myself. Judy did an excellent job of covering the bases about my education. And I did drive over here from Virginia today, and this is not the first time I've been in Louisville. For a number of years, our international bluegrass music organization and trade show, the IBMA, held our annual trade show, convention, and award show here in Louisville at the Galt House. So I made that drive, that long drive on Interstate 64 from Winchester to Virginia to Louisville many times, and I did it again today, and it's very nice to be back. Originally, though, I'm from Georgia, and I did not grow up in a musical family, so if you think my musical roots are because my dad played the fiddle, or my mom played anything, they did not. My dad was a doctor, what we'd called a good old-fashioned country doctor, a general practitioner. My mom was a housewife. There were five girls in our family, all born 2 years apart, and I am the oldest. I got most of my early musical training in the Baptist church. I sang in the youth choir, the adult choir, played piano for Sunday school, and spent most of the time in the sanctuary, when I should have been listening to the sermon, perusing the Broadman hymnal and memorizing words to songs. That's what I like to do the best. I didn't discover bluegrass till I went to the University of Georgia, and for a couple of years I was in the pre-med program because I wanted to be a doctor like my dad. But then I discovered bluegrass, and then my life just did a 180-degree turn. Pre-med went out the door. I bought a banjo. I joined a bluegrass band, Betty Fisher and the Dixie Bluegrass Band. She's a woman that's featured in my book, one of the few women that was leading a band at the time. I was not the banjo player. I was the bass player. And it surely didn't take me very long to realize that being up on stage behind a big bass fiddle in the back of the band didn't give me nearly the attention that the banjo player was getting. So pretty soon I was putting in some pretty hard hours learning to play the banjo so I could be the loudest instrument in the band and get all the attention. That worked out very well. I met my husband, Red Henry, who's a mandolin player, at a bluegrass festival in Livonia, Georgia. We got married shortly after that. We've been married almost 40 years and been playing bluegrass that whole time. Now, for a number of years, we were out on the road playing, but when we had our kids, we sort of pulled back from the road work, and I started teaching more banjo, and we developed this whole method of teaching people to play by ear, and so now we teach them on DVD and have downloads. So if anybody wants to learn to play the banjo, murphymethod.com. Okay, there we go. All righty. Now, before I talk about the book itself, let me just say a word about bluegrass music and sort of its origins and a little tiny bit about the history of bluegrass. Many of you may be very well acquainted with bluegrass music, of course, being from the bluegrass state of Kentucky. But bluegrass, is, as a separate musical genre, is really sort of new. Of course, it has roots in all the music that came before, which would be the hillbilly music, country western music, old-time string band music, and definitely gospel music. But it sort of veered away from these other roots types music and became its own music in the year. Most people consider that to be 1945. Now you can start an all-night conversation about asking what is bluegrass music. You know, somebody will just, you know, you'll come home from a gig and you'll be sitting around, gosh, gee, you know, what do you really think bluegrass music is? And then you're up all night talking about what is bluegrass music. And, of course, that always goes down better if you've got a little Kentucky bourbon in hand to sort of fuel the discussion. Been there and done that. But bluegrass historically is considered an acoustic music played on these main instruments, the banjo, the fiddle, the guitar, the mandolin, the string bass, and then an instrument that's called the dobro, which you may know better as the Hawaiian guitar. But one of the things that separates bluegrass music from its the music that came before, the hillbilly music or the old-time music, is the style of banjo that I was just playing for you right there. That's called the three-fingered style banjo, and you might have seen me put on my finger pick. So on the thumb, you wear this plastic thumb pick, and on your fingers, you wear these metal finger picks, and what it does is make an instrument that's already maybe too loud to begin with even louder. And that, you know, that was a good thing when people were playing for dances or where they were playing in situations when people were very loud, and you had to have the music go over the voices. And that type of banjo was popularized by a man named Earl Scruggs, and that sort of brings us to the starting date of bluegrass music. Most bluegrass historians consider bluegrass to have started, have a real sort of boom, started here. And that was the year 1945 because that is when Earl Scruggs brought his three-finger style of banjo picking to a band that was already appearing on the Grand Ole Opry. And that was Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys. Of course, Bill was from here in Kentucky, from just down the road a ways, Rosine. And he had been playing his old-time string band music for a number of years. And probably if you'd asked Bill Monroe when bluegrass music started, he would have said 1939, because that's when he and his band, the Bluegrass Boys, joined the Grand Ole Opry. But still, they were sort of a string band music. And then Earl Scruggs comes along with his banjo. He joins a band that has Bill Monroe on the mandolin. It has a guitar player named Lester Flatt playing the guitar and singing. And people consider the sort of the coalition of those three instruments coming together at that particular time to be like a big bang theory of bluegrass. Like the day before Earl joined the band, no bluegrass. The day after Earl joined the band, bluegrass. And some people are real adamant about it. Now, the thing that I find so interesting about that is this first aggregation of these, the big three of bluegrass, this band also included a woman in the band. Her name was Sally Ann Forrester, and she played the accordion. And historians have sort of conveniently sort of overlooked that. And that's one of the reasons that I started writing this book, was to bring some of the women who had been ignored, you know, in the bluegrass world back into the history of bluegrass. So that does sort of answer the question about why write a book about women in bluegrass. Well, but it's mainly because most of the books that are written about bluegrass now that are out on the market have very few women in them. If you went to a store and got a book, A History of Bluegrass, you would think from reading that book and other books out there that bluegrass was a man's music. And in fact, some people have defined it that way, as being a man's music, particularly in its early years. But, you know, when I started doing my research, and of course I'm a woman in bluegrass, and so when I started doing the research for this book, I found out that there were plenty of women in bluegrass. And you know, the idea that it was man's music, it was a myth that was so pervasive that I even believed it myself. I mean, I was out there playing the banjo in the 70s, and I thought, gee, it's me and all the rest of the guys. I thought I was one of the guys and just didn't even notice or give any credit, I would have to say, to the other women that were playing out there. In fact, I bought into the myth so much that when I recorded a banjo album, this is what I wrote in my own liner notes. I said, 20 years ago, there were not many women in the bluegrass world, let alone women who played bluegrass scrug style. But, you know, when I started researching, as I said, I found these women. And I think my eyes were opened to this fact. As Judy mentioned, I got my master's degree at George Mason University in Virginia, and my field of study was women's studies. So when they start, you know, you start taking women's studies classes, you learn to see things in different ways. But then you also understand why you saw them the way you saw them to begin with. And this is one of the reasons that this idea of bluegrass being man's music is so pervasive. In the first scholarly work on bluegrass, which came out in 1965, folklorist Mayne Smith wrote this. He was trying to define bluegrass music. I think he'd had too much Kentucky bourbon. He said, bluegrass bands are made up of from 4 to 7 male musicians. Thank you for saying I appreciate that. And then, you know, how these things go. Mayne writes this. It's published in the Journal of American Folklore. It's reprinted in Bluegrass Unlimited magazine, which was the one and only bluegrass magazine for a number of years. And then 40 years later, it's still appearing in print. 40 years later, people are still using this as a definition of bluegrass music. You know, and Mayne is, I now count him as a friend of mine. He wrote this knowing full well that Bill Monroe's girlfriend, Bessie Lee Malden, we're going to talk about her in a minute, played bass in Bill's band for years. I mean, here you got the father of bluegrass music. He's got a woman playing the bass, and yet you have this definition that it's 4 to 7 male musicians. You know, I think Mayne was guilty of the same thing that I was guilty of. You see women out there, but just for some reason, you know, they don't count. They're insignificant. And so I had to come and write this whole book just to prove that women were out there and that they were significant. And many of the women that, because I've been in the business for so long, many of the women that I write about were friends when I started writing the book. So that gave me a lot of access to them. I could call up Laurie Lewis from California on the phone and say, Laurie, I'm writing this book. Can we do an interview? No problem. Other women knew about me because I do write in Bluegrass Unlimited and Banjo Newsletter. So I was a name that was known to them. I was somebody that brought some credentials, you know, to the conversation. And they were very open and forthcoming. They were very willing to talk. And part of the reason is that I don't think anybody had ever asked them before. You know, I said to one woman, we'd done a couple of hours on the phone. It's Missy Range. She's a great bass player. She's won the IBMA Bass Player of the Year many times. I said, Missy, thank you, you know, for giving me so much of your time to talk about your career. And she said, Well, this for me is just like taking a long hot bubble bath. I get to talk about myself for 2 hours. What's not to like? And these women are just so great. So having sort of laid that groundwork about bluegrass to give you a little bit of idea of what the music is and what people were thinking about it, let me tell you about Sally Ann Forrester, that woman that played accordion in what was ostensibly the first bluegrass band. Sally Ann, it may surprise you to find out that Sally Ann is not from what you would consider bluegrass country. I mean, when you sort of think of bluegrass, well, naturally think of Kentucky first. We sort of think of Southeast, you know, maybe like Earl Scruggs was from North Carolina and Lester Flatt was from Sparta, Tennessee. And we had great fiddle players down in Georgia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky. Sally Ann was born in New Mexico. And she was raised by her maternal grandparents in Oklahoma. And her grandfather was an old-time fiddle player. Her grandmother, as far as I know, didn't play. But when Sally Ann was a young girl, she played. She played the fiddle, she played the piano, and she played the guitar, and she loved to sing. I mean, music was just a part of her life. And none of this, it was in any of the bluegrass history books. This is, fortunately, when I started writing this book, I was able to make contact with Sally Ann's son, Bob Forrester, and he gave me access to her yearbooks, her diaries, her autograph books. Remember autograph books from the 1940s and 50s? And her picture albums. So I got this information firsthand. It was really, really fascinating to me. But it does sort of bring up the question, why was Sally Ann overlooked? Here you got a woman who's very musically talented. She played the accordion. She played in Bill Monroe's band. Why did people overlook her? Well, I think there are four reasons. Number one, she was a woman. Number two, she played a non-standard bluegrass instrument, the accordion. Number three, her husband, Howdy Forrester, was the fiddle player in Bill Monroe's band at the same time that Sally Ann was in there. And so this sort of reduced Sally Ann to the status of Howdy's wife, which is how she's often referred to in print. Oh, Howdy's wife. But one of the more pervasive rumors was that when Howdy left the band to go into service in World War II, Sally Ann stayed with the band. So, you know, people just couldn't wrap their minds around the fact that, well, gee, if Howdy left, why would Bill Monroe keep Sally Ann in the band? You know, she's just Howdy's wife. So they started the rumor that she remained in the band so that when Howdy came back from service, he would still have a job because his wife would be in the band. And, you know, and you start looking at that and you're going like, really? You think Bill Monroe, a guy who was so passionate about his music, would keep a woman in the band if she weren't contributing? You think he would be paying an extra person just so his fiddle player could return after 3 years? I don't think so. So that's one of the reasons I think that Sally Ann was disregarded as a musician. But she had made some recordings with Bill Monroe. In early 1945, she had gone with Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys up to Chicago, and they had cut eight, what they called them, sides. They were flip sides of 78 records. Eight sides for Bill Monroe. She played the accordion on all eight sides. And some of these are bluegrass standards, like the Kentucky Waltz and True Life Blues and Footprints in the Snow and Rocky Road Blues. So you have these records that Sally Ann appeared on, and she was also in pictures. But nobody, since nobody knew anything about Sally Ann, there was no, I mean, people just made this stuff up. Sorry, it gets me. All right, but anyhow, so when I was doing my research on Sally Ann, I found out she had a long musical career before she joined Bill Monroe, and this is sort of the piece that was missing. This is what separated her out from being Howdy's wife and being a musician in her own right. So we've got her in Oklahoma. By the time she was a teenager, she was playing on a radio show out there. She performed as the little orphan girl. She wore a complete cowboy outfit. She played the guitar and sang on a radio station in Tulsa. Well, you know, it's interesting how Sally Ann here out in Oklahoma how does she get back to Nashville so she can become a part of Bill Monroe's bluegrass band? Well, I always think it's interesting the way the universe works. So while she's doing this, in Nashville, you have a young Howdy Forrester. He's playing fiddle in a band that's working on the Grand Ole Opry. They've worked the territory out. They need to go somewhere new, so they head to Oklahoma, to the same radio station where Sally Ann's playing. Sally Ann meets Howdy. They fall in love, and then they get married. She was 17, and he was 18. So they stayed out west for a few years, playing at various radio stations. Howdy's brother Joe joined them on the bass. They had a trio, and the music they were playing was not bluegrass, because, of course, it didn't have the banjo, but it was sort of a smooth country western vocal-based music with some fiddle tunes. You think about, you know, Roy Rogers, what a great voice he had, or Gene Autry, the smoothness of that. That was the kind of music they were playing. Now, after Pearl Harbor was bombed, they head back to Nashville because Howdy has to sign up, you know, with the service. He didn't want to be drafted, so he signed up with the Navy so he could have his choice of where he wanted to go in. But he wasn't called into service immediately. So you got musicians, and they have to have work. And naturally, being musicians, they don't want to take day jobs or anything. They want to apply their trade. They want to play music. So they hook up with another Grand Ole Opry act. It was a team of singing comedians called Jam Up and Honey. Great name, don't you think? They as just sort of an aside about Jam Up and Honey, they were some of the last comedians to work in blackface. I mean, they really did that, you know, on live appearances, they did blackface, and on the radio, they spoke in dialect. But they're also excellent musicians. And Honey Wiles was also a really brilliant entrepreneur. He had the idea of taking the Grand Ole Opry show on the road. And he was going to do this by getting a circus tent, traveling, folding it up, bringing everything you needed to put up a circus, but except instead of circus acts, he was going to have musicians on stage. And people laughed at him, and they said, it'll never work, and you'll go broke. And he made money hand over fist. It was just a brilliant idea. So he takes out a tent show, and he has, he's got Sally Ann, he's got Howdy playing with him. He has Bill Monroe as his headliner. So again, the ways of the universe are interesting. So he's got Sally Ann, who's playing in the tent show. He has Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys. Howdy is also playing the fiddle, but with another band. Bill Monroe's fiddle player leaves. He's called into service. Howdy steps into his shoes, and boom, all of a sudden, Howdy's playing the fiddle with Bill Monroe's band. Okay, so hold that in your mind. Now, Bill Monroe was really quite the entrepreneur himself. So he sees how much money that Honey Wiles is making with these tent shows, and he's going like, why do I have to work for Honey Wiles? He says, I will take out my own tent show. Really smart guy. Well, by this time, Howdy has joined the service, and so Bill Monroe is getting together acts to put together to take his tent show out. Well, who does he think of? Well, he thinks of Sally Ann, because he knew from working with her in the past what a great musician she was. And she also, and I'm not sure if Monroe knew this exactly when he hired her, but she was one of the more well-educated people in Monroe's band, and she took charge of all these enormous sums of money that were coming in. So we have Sally Ann playing in Monroe's band. Howdy is nowhere around. He is in service. Sally Ann is playing in Monroe's band. So now what are people thinking about Sally Ann? They're thinking that she's Bill Monroe's girlfriend. You know, just to think. And this was patently untrue because, as a matter of fact, Bill Monroe already had a girlfriend. He also had a wife, too. It was all very complicated. So Sally Ann stays with Bill Monroe in the tent show, and then she stays in the band the following year. And then in 1945, she records with him. And then in December, Howdy comes out of the service. He joins the band again. So now you have Sally Ann and Howdy, along with the big three of bluegrass music, Bill Monroe, Lester Flatt, and Earl Scruggs. Howdy and Sally Ann stayed with Monroe for about three more months, and then they really wanted a lifestyle that didn't require as much traveling. The way Bill Monroe and many of the Opry performers made their living, they would be at the Opry on Saturday night, they would leave at midnight, they would drive as far out as they could and stay out for five or six nights playing the tent shows, or they would play at schoolhouses, and they'd have to drive back to make the Opry on Saturday night. It was a brutal way to make a living. Sally Ann didn't want that any longer because she was pregnant with her first child. So they found work out west playing in, I guess you would call them honky-tonks, playing western swing dance music so that they could sleep in their own beds at night. Sally Ann had her one son, Bob. That was the end of the children for them. Then they kind of had their fill of being out west, and they wanted to be back home. So they moved back to Nashville. Sally Ann retires from music. Howdy stays in the business, becoming the fiddle player with Roy Acuff's band, a band he stayed with for 36 years. But Sally Ann gets out of the business entirely. She goes to work for the Social Security Administration and retires as a mid-level manager. So what do we learn from looking a little bit at Sally Ann's life? She demonstrates, I think, how the first woman in bluegrass carved out a space for herself. So she began as a single girl working on the radio. Then she played in several bands with her husband before the war. She played in Bill Monroe's all-male band during the war. Howdy comes back, plays with her for a little time, and then she goes back out on the road playing music with Howdy after the war. And she did this all in the space of about 10 years. So except for the year of her pregnancy, her musical career was not radically different from that of a lot of other men. Historian Robert Coltman pointed out it's rather typical for a male country artist to quit performing after 5 or 6 years, to settle down, raise a family, and go to work steady near home. So this sort of brings up the question, did her playing in the Bluegrass Boys have an influence on other women in bluegrass? And, you know, and that's a really hard question to answer. And I would love for the answer to be, oh, yes, you know, everybody saw Sally Ann and they're going, oh, she's playing at Bill Monroe, I can play bluegrass music too. But since there was virtually nothing about her in the history books, nobody knew much about her, you know, except on these old recordings, which, you know, became more obscure until CDs came out and they've been re-released. So I can't really say that was true, that women saw her play and followed in her footsteps. But still, you know, she was there. She was a woman in the band. And that, to me, it was important to show that women had been in bluegrass from the very beginning. So having said all that about Sally Ann, I think we need a musical interlude. So off comes the watch. On goes the picks. And I will do a song for you now that... I can't play the accordion, actually. But here's one of the songs that Sally Ann recorded with Bill Monroe. It's one called Rocky Road Blues. When Bill Monroe invented bluegrass music, he said he put a lot of blues in the music. And that's true. There's a lot of blues in the bluegrass music. It's all done to a bluegrass beat. But this is one of those blues numbers called the Rocky Road Blues, and it goes like this. Some other gal. you can see for some bluegrass songs, you don't really need to know a lot of words. One line, sing it three or four times, you got your song. Okay, I'd like to talk just a little bit about Bessie Lee Malden, the woman that I mentioned earlier. She was the girlfriend of Bill Monroe, who played bass with Bill. And if you think, you know, the things I said about Sally Ann Forrester, you know, about people disregarding her playing and saying that she was just Howdy's wife, Bessie Lee had it was even harder for her. Again, she was not written about in the history books because, you know, in bluegrass music, we sort of consider, it's sort of considered to be a sort of a family music. It has deep gospel roots. So historians didn't know what to do with Bessie, you know, since they didn't, they just didn't know what to say about her, so they just didn't say anything about her. Again, when, you know, when there's a vacuum, when people, there's nothing said or written about people, myths and rumors come in. So here's the myth that people said, made up about Bessie Lee. She was a bass player, and just in the work that I did researching the book, I went back and listened to every song that Bessie Lee recorded with Bill Monroe. 112 songs. I mean, she played with him for 12 years. She played on more songs than anybody in Bill Monroe's band except his most famous fiddle player, Kenny Baker. I mean, 12 years, 111 songs. That's a lot of music. So I went back and listened to everything that she had done, and she and it was really paying attention to her bass playing, and she really was a very good bass player. She was really, really good. I talked to other bass players that had seen her play, and one guy who was a bass player now with two important bluegrass groups, the Country Gentlemen and the Seldom Seen, Tom Gray, said he liked Bessie Lee's playing so much he named his own bass after her. I mean, she was really that good, not just my opinion. But anyhow, so Bessie was a very good bass player, but here's the rumor since nothing was written about her. People made this up. They said when Bessie Lee went into the studio with Bill Monroe, her microphone was turned off, and there was somebody else in another part of the studio doing the actual recording. And then the variation on that rumor was, okay, her microphone was turned on, but after they finished the recording session, some guy came in and re-recorded all the bass parts. I mean, it's amazing the lengths that people went to discredit Bessie's playing. And, of course, the other rumor was that she was only in the band because she was Monroe's girlfriend. Now, on some level, that's true. If she hadn't been Bill Monroe's girlfriend, would he have hired her to play bass? No, I don't think so. Nothing that we know about her life before she played with Monroe or after she left the band indicates that she was a musician, you know, in her own right and was going to start her own band or play with somebody else. So she was in the band because she was Bill Monroe's girlfriend. But the thing you have to remember, as we said earlier, Bill Monroe was all about the music. If she hadn't been able to cut her gig, as we say, if she hadn't been a good bass player, she wouldn't have lasted for 12 years. But the other question is, then, why would Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass music, the Grand Ole Opry star, have his girlfriend playing the bass? Why didn't he just hire somebody else to play the bass? Well, Bessie played with Bill in the 1950s and the early 1960s. And this was a time when rock and roll was just, you know, taking over the airways. This was Elvis's time. And a lot of bluegrass musicians and even other country artists who sort of stuck to the old school of music were having trouble finding work. You know, times were hard and times were lean. So Bill Monroe didn't have the money to hire a full band to keep him on the road. So if he had a bass player who knew the music and himself on the mandolin, who could hold the rhythm together, then he could hire pickup musicians and have a band. And so really on that sort of bottom basic level, it was a very pragmatic business decision on Bill's part. Yeah, my girlfriend's there. She can play the bass, and I don't know if he paid her or not. That's one of the questions I just don't know. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But as I was researching Bessie's life, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. Oh, Bessie Lee is the prototype for many women in bluegrass who've maybe never played bass before, but your husband's getting together a bluegrass band. You know, he's got a banjo, he's got a fiddle, he's got a mandolin, he's got a guitar, no bass player. Honey, I have a bass. I think you could learn to play it. And if you have rhythm and you have a little sense of music, the bass fiddle is not too hard to play if you've got some musical smarts. You could pick it up and play passable bass early, not to denigrate anybody's bass playing. Any bass players in the room? No, okay. It can be a very difficult instrument, but at a basic level, you know, it can be done. So Bessie is sort of the prototype, and she stands in for all those women who've done that down through the years. Bessie not only played bass in the band, but she also sang with the band, and this is something that was not known until I started researching her life, and I came across, I can't remember how I got it, a cassette tape of a radio show that Bessie had played with Bill Monroe, and she had sung a number. Now, this was, and I'm going to sing that number for you now, another musical interlude here. It was the Big Kitty Wells hit, it wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels. And I find this song interesting for Bessie to sing because it has a line in it that goes like this. Too many times married men think they're still single. This has caused many a poor girl to go wrong. Well, Bessie always said when she met Bill Monroe when she was a teenager that she didn't know he was married. So I always wondered, I wonder how she felt standing up in Bill Monroe's band and singing this song. You'll hear it? Are y'all familiar with the song as Kitty Wells did it? Oh, that's... Well, maybe I won't do it. No, I'm just kidding. Always better if you have her kid do it. I definitely want to leave room for some questions here at the end, and we're sort of closing up with time. Let me just sort of, this paper doesn't really have a conclusion as such. There's the book. It's got, it's divided into, it's divided by decades. I thought the first book about women in bluegrass should proceed chronologically, so you could see how the roles for women changed in the beginning. So we start in the 1940s with Sally Ann Forrester, we do the 50s, we do the 60s, we do the 70s, and we do the 80s. And then by the time we got to the 90s, there were so many women out there, I titled that last section, Too Many to Count. Because that was the good news and the bad news, too. I can't do all these women, they're too many. I ended up with Alison Krauss, Rhonda Vincent, the Dixie Chicks, of course, and a family band named Cherry Holmes. But you could see as we moved through the decades that in the beginning, as I mentioned, Sally Ann played in band with her husband, although she did have that time when she was playing it just as a single girl. Bessie Lee was in her in the band that she was in because she was partnered with Bill Monroe. Most women's entrance into the music in the 40s and 50s was because they were partnered with somebody. Husband, brother, cousin, boyfriend. There just weren't women out there who were doing it on their own. We didn't start seeing that until the 1960s. There were a few, very few, women that were leading their own bands, and that would have been Patsy Stoneman from the Stoneman family, Gloria Bell, who played for a time with Jimmy Martin, but also led her own band, Betty Amos with Judy and Jean, who had an all-female bluegrass band for a while, and then a woman named Betty Buckland, who was, interestingly enough, from the Boston area, led her own band of all-male musicians for a while until pressures of family and four kids. She just couldn't do it. She had to give it up. And then in the 70s, which is the decade that I entered the music, you start to see more women stepping forward on what we call the lead instruments, the banjo, the fiddle, the mandolin. Not so many women picking the lead guitar. That has been the instrument that the fewest women have taken up, and I'm not sure exactly why that is. But we're starting to see some really great women lead guitar players right now. But that didn't happen until the 70s. So as I say, this talk doesn't have any real conclusion, but I hope you take away from it. I hope I've convinced you that bluegrass is not man's music. Maybe you didn't believe that. Maybe you knew it wasn't. But it was certainly out there in the atmosphere there. I hope I've entertained you. I hope you find the music entertaining. I've tweaked your curiosity to learn more about bluegrass and about the women who've played bluegrass. Here's this book, but let me just remind you that if you go, to the bookstores or you go on Amazon and you look for books about women in bluegrass, well, this is the only one that's out there, but the other history books, no women. So just keep that in mind if you get the bug and you want to start reading more about it. Very, very few women out there. I think it's interesting that even in the culture as it is now, y'all know that Geico ad? Do you see the Geico ad up here? Where they have the two guys that are out there playing the mandolin and the guitar. I'm going like, even the Geico ad has two guys playing. Yeah, that stands for bluegrass music, and it's still men. But women are out there. You just have to look for them. So I'm just going to play one more tune for you and then open the floor to questions. You just can't get up and do a talk about bluegrass and bring the banjo without doing probably what's one of the most recognizable tunes in all of bluegrass. I hope you recognize this. Not doing banjos. This is the tune that Earl Scruggs wrote and recorded when he and Lester Flatt finally teamed up with Flatt and Scruggs after they left Bill Monroe's band. This was used as a theme for the old movie Bonnie and Clyde. That's what I call the Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Thank you. Thank you very much. We got about 10 minutes for some questions. Do we have any questions? Let me set this down here. Yes, ma'am. It's a really good question, and I did, when I was doing the research, have a little bit of information about that. I did my whole master's thesis on her and included some of that information in there, but that was so long ago, I honestly don't remember. I think she got paid the same thing that the guys got paid, which was not very much. But it's a good question. Were women making the same? Wow.
That's why you had so many fiddle players, banjo players.
Right, you guessed. Yeah, very difficult, yeah, to make a living. That's a really good question, though. Somebody, yes, ma'am.
At the Louisville Library, they've been having a series, and some of you may have been there on Tuesday evenings, on American music. And they did Bill Monroe featured in Bluegrass Part. And he was making good money, but he wasn't paying his fellows very much. Did somebody say $60?
Yeah. I'm almost sure that was Flat and Scruggs.
Yeah, they broke off. They say that there were so many passionate young men. They only didn't mention women at all.
I know. Say, there you go.
Young men that Bill Monroe didn't have any trouble getting new players because everybody was so eager to play with him.
I definitely think that's true.
Thank you for
saying that. I mean, it is pervasive, and it's very disturbing to me. When that happens. I mean, the thing about Flat and Scruggs breaking off, after Sally Ann left the band, Earl Scruggs took over the job of handling the money because, again, he was the most educated of the men that were playing with Bill Monroe. And so he knew how much Bill was making. Yeah, you know, you couldn't hide it from him. And, yeah, because he was handling the money. Absolutely. No, he was saying about Bill training. His man did serve as a training ground for musicians, but it took Bill a long time to become comfortable with people being in his band and then going on and starting their own groups because he considered them competitors. I mean, he really tried for years to keep Flat and Scruggs off the Grand Ole Opry, and it wasn't until about the 60s in 60s. That Bill Monroe came to the attention of some historians, Ralph Rensselaer, to be one specifically, who could see that Monroe really had started this new form of music, and positioned him as the father of bluegrass. And so he's going like, I kind of like this. Maybe it is a good idea that I've been training all these guys. And it was interesting in the biography of Bill Monroe, which was written by Richard Smith. Richard was the first bluegrass historian to even say anything about Bessie Lee. So let me just say, if you read the biography of Bill Monroe, Bessie Lee is in there. And Richard Smith says that it was Bessie who talked to Bill and said, you need to talk to Ralph Rensselaer. And Ralph Rensselaer wrote an excellent article in Sing Out magazine calling him the father of bluegrass and talking about all the men that had come through his band and were now out doing this bluegrass music. But in the beginning, Monroe saw them as nothing but competitors. You know, they're getting part of the pie. Let me get this. Yes.
So, sexism was pervasive in all of music, you know, whatever. So, when you were preparing to write this piece, did you look at other genres or read about how women were treated in the history of, say, rock or classical?
No, I mean, I didn't. The one book I did read, and just this was just such a massive undertaking, I didn't really have time to do much of that. But there was one book that had a lot of influence on me. It was a book written by a woman named Sherry Tucker, and she studied all female jazz bands. And when she said in her introduction, when she proposed writing this book about all female jazz bands, people said there weren't any. I mean, that's just, she just Nope, there weren't any. And she did a heck of a lot more research than I did. And she just found lots of women that were playing jazz. And she came up with a phrase that I really liked a lot. She said that, you know, histories that are out there, she was talking about jazz and in swing. She said, you know, the histories are not gender neutral. These are histories of musical men. And she was trying to, you know, bring some correction to that, you know, as I am. But I kind of think you're going to find that in all genres of music. Just, you know, the times are changing. They were what they were. Yes, go ahead.
Back to the pay. $60 a week in the 1940s isn't a huge amount, but I don't imagine that they were paid $60 a week in the 1940s. And now in the 1960s, it was a small amount.
I'm sorry, are you saying $60 in the 1940s would have been a large amount of money?
Yes.
Right. And then, I mean, I guess I see what you're saying, that the large sum of money, but they, you know, they weren't eating at home. They were always eating out, and, you know, they had their dry cleaning expenses, and I guess Monroe probably paid for the gas, but I do take your point. It's not as small as it seems. The amount is not as small as it seems.
They didn't have tour buses either.
They had no tour buses. Oh, no.
Or
that's
staying in
hotels. Or what?
Or staying in hotels very
often. Oh, no. Yeah, right. They must have slept in their cars, right? But did you have a question? Yeah, okay.
I know there are not very many universities that include bluegrass music as a degree. In fact, I only have one right now. It pains me that U of L does not have one. But is anyone talking about adding your book to curriculum?
That's just so interesting that you would say that. I was just down in Raleigh, North Carolina for our big bluegrass convention, and I met a woman there from ETSU. Is that this one you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And she, just interestingly enough, she's a fiddle player. She's in my book. She's from New Zealand. And the only reason she's in my book, because I didn't have time or energy to do women from other countries, she's only in the book because I said, in spite of the fact that Colleen Trenworth is on the cover of Bluegrass Unlimited, I'm not going to talk about women in other countries. So here she shows up in Raleigh. I'm going like, you're in my book. I know. But anyhow, she is teaching now at ETSU. And so she got a couple of copies of the book, and she said she was going to try to show them to the history department, because in the degree of bluegrass, you have to study the history of bluegrass. And she thought it would make a good addition. So my publisher was there at the convention, too, so I hooked those two women up together and talked with the publisher about, okay, we need to see if we can't get this into some, you know, universities. So we are going to work on that. If you're studying history, and in the I don't know if you're familiar with The History of Bluegrass. It's called Bluegrass, A History. And it was written by Neil Rosenberg, and it's been out for 25 or 30 years now. And Neil is a friend of mine, and he said, you know, if he had to do it all over again, he would have included more women in his book. But, you know, like us all, he's a product of his times, you know, as well. And you'd have to be really, really far-thinking to have done the massive research that it would have taken to get that. But if you're using that in a history of bluegrass, you're definitely going to walk away from it thinking that bluegrass is man's music and women aren't in it. So I'm hoping this will add some balance.
Is there a final question?
A final question?
We're just not sure. What about the Coon Creek Girls?
What about the Coon Creek Girls? The Coon Creek Girls, which, you know, led by Lily Mae Ledford, are a band that I consider pre-bluegrass. And because they didn't have the Scruggs-style banjo in it. And I just made my definition of bluegrass really narrow. And I think I could take some heat for that. But to include the Coon Creek Girls and Molly O'Day and the Carter family, it was overwhelming to me. And so I just defined bluegrass as being the music that had the banjo played three-finger style, Scruggs style. And that let me easily start with Sally Ann Forrester and then work from there. I mean, there's a whole nother book to be written about the women that played what we call old-time music, and they would certainly be at the top of the list. The new Coon Creek Girls are in the book, though, because, you know, they took the name. Yeah.
Question.
Yes?
What do you mean by old-time music? What instruments are played with old-time music? And is that a singing style that's kind of twangy and kind of high?
Well,
we don't know.
Well, people would say bluegrass is twangy and high. I think the difference in the old time music is primarily, I mean, a lot of it is in the way that the banjos played. You know, this thing about wearing the picks, which I showed you, you know, that I put those on. Old time banjo, which I cannot play, is done with your bare fingers, and it's not exactly a strumming. We call it claw hammer, or we call it drop thumb, or we call it rapping the banjo. That's a bad imitation of that. But it is different and doesn't have the same, people would say maybe the drive as bluegrass. But it's vocal music. The other thing about old time music is, in bluegrass, you saw me when I performed and did, I picked the banjo and then I sang. In bluegrass, all the instruments take turns doing a lead playing. So I'd take a turn playing the banjo, then somebody would sing, then the fiddle would take a turn playing, and somebody would sing. In old time, most of the time, all the instruments play at the same time. So you got the banjo playing its lead part at the same time and not backing off. What, you know, in bluegrass, when I'm not playing my lead part, I do these little chords, which I hate because it's so boring and it's not loud. And nobody looks at me when I do this. But in old time, they do all play together. It's very rhythmic, and it makes great dance music. So that was a precursor to bluegrass, I think. Does that help? It gets kind of tangled. Are we done?
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.